Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, welcome to Week, the Political Roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California. It's Wednesday, April 26, 2017. Now, you all saw this week, Ivanka Trump went to Berlin. She got kind of a touchy reception there. Stephen Colbert said this was actually the first Trump to attend a women's conference that did not include a swimsuit competition. So, you know, that's a first. Well, listen, I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we're going to talk about the fights over conservative speech at UC Berkeley. We'll look at the president's first 100 days. We'll check in on Dianne Feinstein and other political news. And, of course, we'll end the day with our live news quiz. As always, I note that the Commonwealth Club is a place for people from a wide range of views, so any opinions that are expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end with Chuck Nevias, the columnist for the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, former columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's on Twitter at CW Nevias. Next to him is Melissa Kane, a political and legal analyst for CBS San Francisco. That's KPIX5. She's on Twitter at MelissaKane1. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And next to me is Molly Riley. She's the deputy politics editor for Huffington Post, or is it now just
HuffPost? Now HuffPost.
HuffPost.
As of yesterday.
New design, new name. And she's on Twitter at Molly Riley. So glad you're all with us. There are question cards throughout the room. You all know how that works. Write out some questions, and we'll pick them up and deliver them to me, and I will try to ask as many as I can. Now, on to our roundtable. This week, conservative speaker, writer, provocateur, Ann Coulter was scheduled to speak at the University of California, Berkeley, but the school canceled the speech, citing concerns over safety. Coulter then announced and then unannounced that she was going to speak here anyway on Thursday. But this was not the first case where safety concerns and conservative speakers there have clashed. Let's use that. A recently right-wing personality, Milo Yiannopoulos, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, he had a speech at UC Berkeley canceled after protests there turned violent. Conservative David Horowitz, he had a speech there canceled earlier this month. So let's talk about this, and maybe let's start with Melissa. Does Berkeley have a problem with controversial speech? What are the issues here? So
we know Berkeley has kind of become a fight club, right? I mean, people kind of go there because they think they can get away, and rightfully so, it seems, just sort of fighting right there, right in the open. In addition to the issues with Yiannopoulos and Horowitz and Coulter, we've had two incidents in this sort of center, the Civic Center Park in Berkeley, where pro and anti-Trump folks have come out and really just, you know, beaten each other up pretty good. So I talked to the chief of police of the Berkeley PD, and this is the city police, not the campus police, because they have them. They're a small but dedicated university group of police.
Unobtrusive.
They're stealth. And he said, look, this is new. We haven't seen anything like this. I think to some degree, they're all caught off guard by what they're seeing, the intensity, the organization, the numbers, the tactics that these groups are using have really kind of caught everyone off guard. He said, what's different about this group and what's different, look, Berkeley's no stranger to protests, right? What's different is that it's not just the people who are fighting, it's that there are people right next to them who are watching, who are filming, who are inches away, not doing anything wrong. And so what he said is the concern is, from the police standpoint, is if we go in and start, you know, grabbing people and, you know, putting them in the, you know, in the trucks and arresting them, that we're going to grab somebody who wasn't doing anything wrong. And if we do that, then holy crap, you know, horrible, horrible backlash. I don't think it's a legal issue as much as it is sort of a PR issue. I think they're very concerned about that. So what he said, that's kind of what we have that's different. Not only is it this violence, but it's this violence with a lot of onlookers sort of mixed in. And so it's hard to know or hard to be able to efficiently separate, you know, people who are breaking the law from people who aren't. So they do have a problem in the sense that any town that has this experience has a problem. And the chief of the Berkeley University Police, or the captain of the University Police, said that they're getting calls from schools all over the country trying to figure out what tactics they should use to deal with this issue. So it's a new issue. They're kind of clearly muddling their way through it. They're making some mistakes. It does look like they've got this sort of secret policy that they've applied now to several conservative speakers, that's really undefined and is what the basis of, you know, there's a lawsuit now. They're suing the Young College Republicans and the Young Americas Foundation. The sponsors of the Coulter event are now suing Berkeley, saying, you know, you're violating our First Amendment rights because you're imposing this like double secret policy that you won't explain and define and let us know what it is, and you're only applying it against conservative speakers. And so they've left themselves open to that. It's a messy, messy situation, and they're sadly both, right there on the world stage in a very confusing time when they're going to have to come up with some new tactics, maybe even some new laws, maybe even making it unlawful or some sort of misdemeanor to sort of jump in and get in the mix to be so close so you could give the officers a way to go in and sort of break up fights without worry that they're going to, you know, sort of grab lawfully acting people on the net. But yeah, I mean, it's... And I asked, I said, are you nervous? Are you concerned? This is to the Berkeley police chief. Are you concerned that this has become a fight club, that people think that this is the place to come and just bring your brass knuckles and, you know, let those liberals have it or let those conservatives have it and really just let out all this pent up anxiety that you have on one side or the other? And he said, yeah, you know, we are concerned and our community is concerned, and they know they've got to figure it out. And again, we've got the lawsuit, we've got this policy that's coming, and Coulter has now said the latest is that she's not coming to speak, although she may come to just hang out. I don't know. But they're clearly trying new things. The police chief said that there were going to be more. He said it's going to be us, it's going to be the Berkeley University Police, and a bunch of other people. So it seemed to me like they were finally going to bring in maybe some folks, some police. You guys remember during Occupy, Oakland brought in some Alameda sheriffs and brought in, you know, people from other jurisdictions to help them deal with the Occupy folks. Something like that, where they would be bringing in San Francisco police officers or, you know, Alameda or even CHP. I mean, it doesn't matter, right? You can bring in folks from other jurisdictions so that they're even ready to do that. So they're freaking out a bit and kind of muddling through. I think eventually they will figure out a better system to deal with this. But this groups, these organized, you know, numerous leftist groups are something that the university and the town just is not prepared to deal with.
Molly, what do you take about
seeing? Well, it's hard not to feel like this is exactly what Ann Coulter wanted to happen. You know, this is kind of her jam. This is like what she and Milo and others in this sort of alt-right sphere do, is they say outrageous things, they do outrageous things, and then they rail against liberals for, you know, being snowflakes or calling for safe spaces and things like that. And I think Berkeley is really the perfect place for her to do something like this, where, you know, she wants to speak and they are saying that they don't have the security to deal with it. And then she can say, well, the home of free speech, that where the free speech movement happened, is saying that I don't have free speech rights. So I think they're really in a tough spot right now. I think it's hard for them to, you know, obviously all these security issues are a huge consideration. They have students to protect. They have the property to protect on campus. But also they have the free speech that they have, you know, made a bedrock of their campus to defend. So I think it's tough.
Excuse me. Chuck, someone from the audience asks about, you know, this looking like anything that's not left-wing speech is suppressed there. This does certainly play into those optics of, you know, these are not conservative groups turning violent about a left-wing speaker. It's the other way around. I mean, I started this off by saying, does Berkeley have a problem with controversial speech? Does it have a problem with conservative speech, including right-wing speech, which I'll separate from mainstream conservative speech?
Right, and I think it's just turned Berkeley into such a punching bag. Bill Maher said it used to be a cradle of learning. Now it's just a cradle. You know, it's the... I'm struck I'm struck by what a small group, the tyranny of the few. I mean, I watched the Yiannopoulos riot in real time on TV, and there were not that many people breaking windows and throwing things and so forth, and yet they were able to completely control the debate. And even the Young Republicans said afterwards, we're so distressed, this is not what we had in mind at all. These guys show up with hoods and masks and weapons and so forth, and it's a violent confrontation. But it's not that many people. And I'll take you all the way back to the Black Lives Matter with the Martin Luther King a couple of years ago, the Martin Luther King ceremony right over here at Yerba Buena. And Mayor Lee was there. He was shouted down by protesters. There were 8 protesters. 2 of them were yelling. You know, but it has become, and I would also include Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos as those 2, also a very small group. Ann Coulter said, liberals love America like O.J. loved Nicole. I mean, that's the kind of stuff she says.
I don't even know what that means.
Well, it doesn't have to mean anything. It's just, yeah, exactly. What is it? O.J. killed Nicole.
What?
Oh, yes.
Oh. We have to talk later.
I shouldn't have broken to you like that. That's right. But you know, the point is, it's a group. It's a very small group on all sides that are controlling the agenda, and that I think is frustrating to all of us who, as I said, watch those windows being broken, watch those people throwing those things, and it was like, isn't someone going to do something? And yet, as Melissa said and as Molly said, it's going to be on video. When those cops step in and bring out those long clubs, it's going to be all over the nightly news. So I think socially, philosophically, legally, they're in a tough spot. But I would just say again, I think it's the tyranny of the few. There aren't that many people who are involved in violent confrontation, and yet they have taken over the debate.
Well, I was at UC Davis when Milo Yiannopoulos was also scheduled to speak, and it was shut down because of this group. And I will tell you, 99% of the folks who were there were peaceful. They were holding signs. Many of them looked like students. And then all of a sudden, it gets a little dark, and a group of people show up. They don't appear to be students at the university. They just show up to do this, mm-hmm. to shut mm-hmm. this down. Mm-hmm. And they're a small group, and they know what they're doing. And campus police caught totally off guard. And it ends up, you know, having the desired effect. But legally speaking, you can't give in to what's called a heckler's veto. And that just means you can't just start shutting things down because of the unpopularity of the speech. There is a famous case of the KKK who wanted to do a parade in Skokie, I think.
And the key to this, for those of you not from Illinois, Skokie, Illinois, is not only a heavily Jewish area. At the time, it had a lot of Holocaust survivors living in it. So, yeah.
Right. So there's that. The town said, look, we can't provide security for you here. This is, you know, what you're doing is bananas right in the middle of our town. We can't let you do this because we can't keep you safe. And the Supreme Court said, no, you have to do what you have to do to make sure that opposing views, you know, have the same rights to public spaces as anybody else. Now, the Supreme Court did not determine how much, you know, is it unlimited? You have to spend every dollar in the city's coffers or the university's coffers to make that happen. They haven't addressed that yet. That's actually sort of something that this could set a precedent for. But they did say that you can't just say, like, no, this is really hard and people here hate you, so you don't get to speak. The unpopularity of the speaker cannot determine their access to facilities is what so far the legal sort of precedent is. I think at some point there has to be a ceiling on, you know what you're expected to do. But whatever it is, it needs to be applied regardless of viewpoint, and so applied to liberal as well as conservative speakers. So, for example, the one they talk about at Berkeley is the Dalai Lama came to the campus, right? And so they charged the group that was, and not that there was like big protests over the Dalai Lama, but controversial figure for some folks. They charged $20,000. To provide security for that event because they knew, you know, it was going to be controversial. So, you know, setting up a framework like that for controversial speakers is something, you know, that all universities are going to have to do, and they're going to have to sort of bake in those security costs. But you can't just say these people are horrible, so you don't get to speak. That's a problem.
Philosophically, I think we all understand that, you know, Ann Coulter can come to Berkeley and we can ignore her. I mean, she's a nut, and we can ignore her. And that's the way it's worked for a long time. That's sort of the premise of the American Free Society. And the idea that I'm offended by you, therefore I'm not going to let you even speak, that's the difference. And that's the moment when we all sort of say, well, what should we be doing about this? And then when it becomes violent, we're also it's that much more difficult. But the entitlement of that group of people to say, you cannot even speak because I disagree with you, fundamentally, that's not what we're founded on, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are folks who would argue, it's interesting that this is Berkeley. Now, I even separate the whole free speech movement, which wasn't about conservative speech, it was about anti-war radical speech in the 60s. But it is known as a campus that is very left, and again, someone from the audience is pointing out, you know, there's an issue of the faculty and that the entire atmosphere there is one that is not tolerant of conservative views. I'm not a Berkeley student, nor a faculty, so I can't really say if that's perception or reality.
But you could pass for one, John, I would just like to say.
Actually, I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which has been called the Berkeley of the Midwest.
There we go. But I
find that interesting when I hear those views aired, because what I've learned, and we get a lot of young folks working at the club, a lot of interns from Berkeley, and what I hear from them often is it's a much more conservative campus than they thought. Mm. You've got a lot more international students there who are coming in from completely different backgrounds and such. So I don't know if anyone has any views on it.
Interestingly, what we've heard from the campus Republicans, and we don't have statistics to back this up, but according to Berkeley campus Republicans, since these things started to happen, since the Milo Yiannopoulos event back in February, they've had a 5-fold increase in people attending their meetings. It is having the opposite effect. It is now, it's a forbidden fruit, whatever, you know, like it's causing people to take a real interest in this group, these speakers who are so horrible, they're not even allowed to speak. People are, you know, oh, well, interesting. You know, when you're a kid and you see the R rating come up and it's like mature audiences only, you're like, okay, this is exactly what I want to watch. So you sort of paint it like this and you make it more attractive. And they said that their membership or their attendance at their meetings has gone through the roof.
I would say Berkeley campus Republicans sounds like the ultimate oxymoron, but I, at this point, I guess it's true.
I'll see if they can get you a shirt.
Oh, that'd be good.
Yeah. Well, let's move on for a bit then and talk about President Donald Trump's first 100 days. Let's talk about actual policies he's pushed or gotten done or not gotten done, and if we know why. Molly, let's start with you. What's your take on the first 100 days of Trump?
Well, I think the 100 days distinction is interesting because it's kind of a meaningless media-driven timeline, but it's one that Trump embraced at the beginning of his presidency. He said he had all these things he wanted to get done in the first 100 days, and now he's kind of walking that back. He's saying, 100 days doesn't matter, all that. And I think that's because he hasn't had the victories that he wanted to have. Obviously, several of his executive orders, the most high-profile ones, the immigration ban and now the sanctuary cities federal funding order, both of those are held up in courts right now. The healthcare bill went down in flames. A lot of the executive orders that he has signed are things that are directing agencies to do things or to review policies. Like he signed one today asking Betsy DeVos to look at the Department of Education and if there was areas of federal overreach that should be rolled back. But not a lot of concrete policy victories. Legislatively, there's pretty much nothing. I would say the most concrete victory he's had is getting Neil Gorsuch on the court. But you could argue that that was more Mitch McConnell's victory than Trump's. And then he also passed an executive order where for every regulation that gets passed, 2 have to be repealed, which is already having impacts. And he rolled back some of Obama's executive orders on climate. So those are things that have real impacts and are important. But I think for his optics, I think he hasn't gotten what he really has wanted to do. And I think that's why this week we're seeing all kinds of stuff coming out of the White House. They're talking about backing out of NAFTA. We have the tax plan that they released late last night. There's just all kinds of stuff that they're talking about, this new healthcare bill, the border wall, trying to get that in, even though the shutdown is looming on Friday night. So I think, we're still seeing optics be number one in Trump's mind, and I don't think that he's really gotten the publicity push he wants.
And I do want to get into the tax proposal. You might have seen that a little bit later. Melissa, I mean, she's right about it being kind of a media thing, and it's funny, oftentimes Ronald Reagan is held up as someone who, first 100 days, I was reading something that he didn't get stuff passed in his first 100 days either. Am I
Well, I mean, remember, too, for conservatives, right, you're not trying to affirmatively do things so much as you're trying to undo things, right? And so, and he's done, you know, he's definitely gotten rid of some things, put in some place, put in place some rules to roll back regulation. Yeah. So, you know, it's hard. You're not looking for like these, you're not looking at like FDR for the Public Works Administration. Like, you're not going to see the creation of new agencies for a successful conservative. So to some degree, we have to make sure we look at it through the proper lens that, you know, success in that realm means getting rid of stuff. And so it, with the 100 days thing, it is just optics, but doesn't Trump love optics? You know, like, this is a man who's like shuttling all the senators to the White House tonight to talk about North Korea when the room that they should be doing this in is not at the White House. It's over in Congress. But, you know, you like, we're going to bring him to my house. You know, like, this is a man really, you know, who is into optics. And so it does seem to be something he's sort of struggling with, trying to say, oh, it doesn't matter. But I think we kind of all know it doesn't. It does to him. He's pulled out of the TPP. He's, you know, there's some things I think that he can point to. I mean, I think Sean Spicer listed off like the renaming of a veterans hospital in Pago Pago or something like that is one of his pieces of legislation. We're like, good on you.
He is talking about pulling out of NAFTA now.
And now he's talking about pulling out of NAFTA. And look, to some degree, this like anything else seems to be like a first firing. You know, so again, he's a negotiator. Yeah. It seems like it's, we'll pull out. Well, then we'll negotiate the terms of NAFTA as opposed to pulling out, like sort of, you know, sort of first bid in a negotiation. So I'm not sure he's necessarily going to do that, but he definitely, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time, as you all know. It's great to see all the familiar faces here. You know, there were times when we'd be sitting back in the room and going, okay, what are we going to talk about? Not a problem. Not a problem. And I hope we're doing okay. Frankly, for me, the 100 days is more like, how are we doing? How's America doing after that first 100 days? Can we all just, even an artificial deadline to just say, are we okay? Everybody okay? We're muddling through? Okay, that's good. It matters not just for the presidency, but for the public as well.
Chuck?
I've always thought a great truth is there's nothing easier to maintain than a bad reputation. And if you...
Sound like my mom.
Yeah. If you start with something like, you know, the Chinese are currency manipulators, and then you say, no, they're not. They're not currency. At first, everybody's like, what? He just said the opposite of what he just said. And then you say, NATO is obsolete. And you say, it's not obsolete anymore. Then little by little, you just start saying, well, that's just him. You know, that's the way he is. He's got that thing. I've been strangely encouraged by the fact that the media continues, I think, to try to do a good job. And almost to the point of bending over backwards when he does something somewhat presidential, and we say, look at that, he's turning the corner, we've got it all worked out here. It still is an important office. It's still an office with influence, power, and it represents the American people. And I think that everybody's playing along with it, and little by little, he's kind of being pulled along to do that. I think he's still an impulsive bully who will probably make a lot of bad decisions, but I think he is finally getting the idea that this is not a hobby. This is an important job that a lot of people who are very smart know a lot about, and you don't know that much about it. So it's fascinating to watch, as long as he doesn't get us in a war with North Korea, which will not be as interesting to watch, I don't think. I don't think that would be so much fun. But I keep hearing the media, I keep hearing the questions even to Sean Spicer. People will say, I'd like to ask you about such and such. Now, admittedly, this has... They're couching it. They're trying to play it right down the middle, which is great. But this is a test. This is a real test of the American people.
Excuse me. What do you think of the Democrats? I mean, you're during their 100 days, talking about judging other people, not just the president. How have they been? How have they adapted to being completely or almost completely out of power in Washington?
Excellent. That's great. You know, take over the Republican thing and just lob tomatoes at whatever they do. It's great. Nancy Pelosi has come into her own, I think. She can't wait. She's got that right hand all fired up. Let me in there. I'm ready to go. You know, the wall is ridiculous. You know, all that stuff. No, I think that the Democrats realized that they had an opportunity, and I think the real key, as we've said it here before, is that if Republicans feel like he's not helping, A, and he can't hurt me, B,
right,
I think he's going to be a lonely fellow there, because all this, he's blustered, he's tried to intimidate people, isn't really working. And if these elections prove that he doesn't have any coattails either, you know, last person out, close the door, because they're going to be out of here. They're not going to defend that. And it'd be up to him to keep it going. So it'll be interesting to see.
I think to some degree, Nancy Pelosi is having a good time sitting back watching Paul Ryan try to rein in and be like, Oh, look, see, I got all my people to vote for Obamacare. Just waiting on you to do that on your side. Right. And has done a good job of reining in the Democrats so that there is no, everyone's like, oh, maybe he can get some moderate Democrats. Oh, no. That's not a thing that's going to happen. She runs a tight ship, and right now Paul Ryan is looking very deficient compared to what she was able to do. I think there are a lot of people, I don't care what your politics are, who understand this woman was, I mean, what she accomplished as Speaker, getting folks together to take the votes that they did, is hard. We're seeing now how hard it is. And you know, some folks are wishing that Paul Ryan had some of those chops and inability to keep his party together in the way that she did. Having said that, here are some things that we have not seen. We have not seen, at least I haven't, an autopsy.
What do you mean?
The Democratic Party laid a huge egg. This is a family event. Laid a huge egg. And so far, all I have heard from them is, we have to do our messaging better. And this is the same thing we heard from Republicans in 2008 when Barack Obama won. Oh, you know what? He was better at Facebook. You know what? We gotta say our message better. We gotta have like fancier commercials. It's not. We're grownups. We heard your message. but there seems to still be a profound inability or unwillingness among some Democrats, most Democrats at the leadership levels at least, to acknowledge that it is not the way you said stuff, it is the stuff. And you need to think about your platform and what you're willing to give on and not give on going forward, because the introspection that one would expect after losing everything is not there. Mm-hmm. And even now, when there's like a ton of infighting. There's, you know, for the leadership position, and now we're endorsing some Democrats but not others, and they're sort of getting very coy about certain things. So I still think the Democratic Party has a lot of work to do. Being the "we're not Trump" party will only get you so far. You really do need to take this opportunity to do some genuine introspection and not just say, "Let's Facebook better." It's what is our platform? What do we need to change about that will make us have broader appeal to the American public? So, you know, I think it's been a great show for Nancy Pelosi, again, for who's been able to sort of really be a great contrast to Paul Ryan. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. And I'll add one thing. The groups that have sprung up since the election, Indivisible, there are other groups that have sprung up, are not Democratic Party groups, right? It tells you something very important, that the people who are now organizing themselves to oppose Donald Trump are not going through the party. There is a clear unwillingness or lack of desire to affiliate with the Democratic Party. And now we're seeing all these extra party groups spring up that don't affiliate with the party. And the party needs to ask themselves why that is. Why are they so, unpopular? Why are they so ugly that other groups, that these new groups of people who've never participated in politics before, right? These are people who are grassroots, newly energized folks, and they are creating their own institutions instead of joining one. And that, I think, is a big problem for Democrats. If they can't somehow find a way to swallow those folks up, they're going to be in big trouble. There is a lot of these extra party groups happening right now, and I think that should send a big message to the party.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think there hasn't been too many tests yet of Democrats. I think the Supreme Court fight was a major one. They did force McConnell to go nuclear with the filibuster, and some of the confirmations they challenged pretty strongly. Jeff Sessions came down to Mike Pence having to be the tiebreaker. But other than that, there haven't been real opportunities for Democrats to stand up. The GOP is kind of imploded on its own. The infighting has really benefited the Democrats in this case. So I think it'll be interesting to see what goes forward as, you know, they start working on healthcare again. There's a bill right now that's going through the House. It looks like it may pass the House. The Senate is a little bit iffy. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
And then on healthcare.
On healthcare. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then with these special elections that are happening, Georgia, with the first round was last week. It's headed to a runoff, and the Democrat in that race, John Ossoff, looks like he could potentially win. And if that happens, I think that's a real going to be a rallying point for Democrats in these districts that are conservative, but where voters are, you know, maybe not happy with the way things are going. We're seeing a lot of Democratic challengers popping up in red districts. Here in California, in Orange County, there's a bunch of Democrats running in, against Mimi Walters. Devin Nunes just got a challenger. So I think those are going to be the things that we really have to look to see how Democrats are doing in this era.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Chuck? Two quick things. One is the Ryan struggles just show that the Republican Party continues to be a very divided party. They were before, they still are, and they're having problems just getting their own agenda out now that they finally have the opportunity. And second, there are so many people that are still blaming FBI Director Comey, still blaming the Russians. Granted, they had an effect, but I'm reading Shattered, I'm reading the book about the campaign, the Hillary Clinton campaign. They ran a very difficult to like, somewhat unpopular candidate who had no challengers because it was going to be a coronation. And they miscalculated badly on who they should have been speaking to, who they should have been reaching out to. And it's not Comey's fault that happened. And Trump, for all of his flaws, tied into this anger, this middle class loss of prestige, job, and self-esteem that made a difference in his campaign. And that's how desperate people were.
Any New York Magazine readers here? New York, did you see the Frank Rich article, which was saying that, not the current issue, I think it was the one before that, saying that Democrats should not go chasing after these Trump voters, saying that, you know, there are core historical Democratic issues on which Democrats should reaffirm themselves, you know, talking about labor and such, but don't bother going after, as he was putting it, the hillbilly vote. You're not going to get them, and you will change yourself in a bad way by going after them.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, I don't know. I don't know who they're supposed to go after. That's exactly.
I mean, if she ran this campaign that people want to say was so horrible, and yet she got the second most votes of any candidate ever for president.
Yeah. I think that's
78,000 of them in the wrong place.
Right. You know, as we all know, Saturday Night Live used to be very funny. It's not as funny as it used to be. But they did do, I thought, a very clever thing when they had the TBD, to be determined. And they did a supposed news story from the future about how, luckily, a new Democratic leader has come up. And they'd show the statue, and it was just a straight block of stone because it was to be determined. We don't have that person. But Nancy Pelosi, God love her, Dianne Feinstein, wonderful person, you know, Hillary Clinton, this is, if there's a message they got out of that campaign, that was old politics. Who are those new people? Is it Kamala Harris? Is it Gavin Newsom? Who, I don't know who it is. But that's the transition they're going to have to make. And those people will be dragged, kicking and screaming, but I think that's what we're going to have to do is see that next, who is that next generation and what new idea do they have?
Well, you know, I'm from Georgia, so I'll take issue with that hillbilly comment. Because I'll tell you, number one, the hillbillies won. So there's that. And also,
and remember, Frank Rich is from New York City.
See?
So everyone outside of Manhattan is a hillbilly.
Limousine liberal. But also, remember, I mean, in the South, when I grew up, my representative was a Democrat, right? Up until the 90s. Mm-hmm. These were Democrats. So this idea that you have to contort yourself into an unrecognizable shape to get elected in these places, I don't know that that's true. I think that there, you know, there are certain issues that sides don't want to give on, but I don't know that you say, oh, well, forget it. We're just going to, we're only, I mean, this is what was the problem with the Clinton campaign. We're only going to campaign in these certain places because we're going to either chalk you up or write you off, and then we're just going to campaign in whatever is left from all of that. And I think that that cost her some of the precious Electoral College votes. So, Frank, I know you watch this. This hillbilly respectfully disagrees with that. You know, with that assessment, that you're never going to get their votes. Mm-hmm. These are people in like who have long family histories of voting for Democrats, Dixiecrats, granted, but with a D. It is not unheard of, you know, among Southerners to vote for a Democrat, and you could get back some of those folks again, as we saw with the Ossoff election. What was important about the Ossoff election wasn't just how close he came, but it was how many people voted. I mean, the enthusiasm in a primary election, in a primary special election, like, you just don't get lower turnout than what we did, than the kind of election we just saw down there. And the enthusiasm, the number of people who came out and voted, that was what was important. And so Democrats, you got to get people fired up to turn out, and then they can make it a real race in some of these places that people want to write off.
Not to wear it out, and we all want to, you know, you can see the Democrats defending Obamacare and understand why they're doing that, and they want to do all those things. But that health care plan does have real problems. And we're all tired of hearing about the countries in Europe who do such a great job. But in a lot of ways, they do. They keep health costs down. There is a way to do this in a middle ground. I just listened to a podcast the other day, and this woman was saying that in today's market, if polio was a problem in today's market, we wouldn't have a cure. We'd have 7 different kinds of iron lungs in every color. You know, that would be there because it's actually better to treat someone for a lifetime rather than to cure them because you make more money over the period of time. There are problems with healthcare. There are problems with medical costs. There are problems with prescription drugs. There's nothing wrong with saying that. It's doing something about it without getting defensive. And I think there's room to do it for Democrats, for God's sake.
Okay. I've had several people write in cards asking about this, so we've got to talk about the tax plan, the tax proposal, kind of the initial outlines that the White House, was it today or tomorrow, yesterday that they came out with it?
Today.
Today. So what do you think, you know, is what sort of reception, Molly, is this getting on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think the numbers, I'm not exactly the numbers, but I think Trump wants to cut the corporate rate into 15%, which is a huge, huge cut for the wealthy and will mostly benefit wealthy corporations and wealthy people. So that is obviously something that is not going to play well with a lot of his base and is something that a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill don't want to happen because it's going to add so much to the deficit, or likely would. And anything that adds to the deficit is something that they won't vote for. So I think he's going to hit up against a wall there on Capitol Hill. I think they'll probably meet somewhere in the middle. But the fact of the matter is this is a huge, huge gift to the rich and something that Trump himself would likely benefit from, although we aren't sure exactly how he would benefit since we haven't seen his tax returns. But yeah, I think, you know, the big story here is how much he's giving to the wealthy with this.
And we should maybe give some detail on this. I guess they're talking about, they want to go from 7 different levels tax brackets down to 3. The top would go down from 39.5 to 35, and then, of course, the corporate would go down to 15. I guess the 20, and there would be a 10, and the 25, I guess, would stay the same, right? Melissa?
Well, next to the word vague in the dictionary is a picture of that tax plan. I mean, that all sounds great. Oh, gosh, let's just cut taxes down to 15%. But even at the press conference today, I was just telling Melissa, my wife has had a surgery, so we're at home all the time. I'm retired. We never miss the Sean Spicer Hour. We watch it every single day. And they brought 2 people up there today to try to explain what was going on, and they were like, whoa, you're getting so detailed about this. We don't know what, you know, we'll just, it's just sort of an overall, you know, that there's a million details, and I think what eventually appears will be much different than what we introduced.
Well, one thing that's in there that was interesting, and one of our audience folks asked about this, was its impact on California. And in it is the desire to, you would not be able to take a deduction on your
state
income tax for your, if you're federal, or you wouldn't be able to deduct your federal
You would not be able to deduct the taxes that you pay to your state.
Thank you.
In your federal taxes. No. And that would really hit New York, California, are two of the big states that have the state income taxes. So it's really harmful. First of all, I think that we need to view this one pager as an opening bid. You know, I don't think that this is something they're going to insist on, you know, down to every line. I think that this is sort of, so it sounds a bit extreme, but I think that there's some wiggle room. For example, Donald Trump has talked about a 20% corporate tax, and he wants to get it down to 15. So it seems like there's some, you know, he can give a few points. So, you know, let's just recognize that this is just, you know, a thought piece and not an actual law, because there's so many things happening that they're going to have to deal with. Having said that, I think he did tap into one thing that I think is important. We need to simplify. Now, there have been efforts in California, for example, to do this, and they are constantly shot down by places, companies like TurboTax, companies like H&R Block, companies that benefit from a complicated, messed up, screwed up system, and they get to be the ones to come in and you pay them to sort of uncomplicate it for you. That industry absolutely murders every attempt to simplify our tax code. And if we could get, you know, honestly, maybe it sounds horrible to say, but I would pay a little more in taxes if it wasn't so insane to file in this country. If I didn't have to pay someone else, I would rather pay to fix potholes than to pay, you know, somebody at H&R Block to do this stuff. And so I think that there is some enthusiasm and interest among American people to say, yes, part of the plan is to reduce the deductions down to mortgage, charitable giving, and retirement. And that's it. And just forget it. None of the other stuff. And that's going to have some impacts, some good and bad impacts on various groups of people. But, you know, you've got like the yacht deduction. You've got all sorts, like, it's crazy. So I think that that's a good thing. I was actually happy to see that, you know, that we were going to get to back to like a more streamlined way to approach this. And if we could say, if that could make it through the process, that would be amazing. The other thing I think is important about this plan is, remember, the plan bakes in a ton of growth, right? The plan says, we're going to cut the crap out of taxes, but we're going to grow the crap out of the economy, and so that's all, you know, even Steven. And so I think that, you know, there's this constant debate about does lowering taxes lead to growth? Does raising taxes, you know, lead to smaller growth? And that, I won't say the jury's still out. I will say if you look at historically, it doesn't make any difference. Frankly, sometimes tax rates are high and the economy does great. Sometimes tax rates are low and the economy does great. That argument is going to be front and center, because in order to get this through the Senate without 60 votes, the administration is going to have to show that this does not have a deficit impact beyond 10 years. And I'm not sure that that's going to be a thing that they can do based on the current plan. Now, the current estimate is like $5.5 trillion over the next 10 years. I don't think they're going to be able to explain that away. So we're going to see this debate over the impact of taxes on the economy. It's going to be a huge thing, and it's going to matter, because if the administration is somewhat wrong, if it won't actually just sort of zero out because things will be so awesome that we won't we won't contribute to the deficit, then you're going to need Democrats in the Senate, and then, you know, sort of everything falls apart from there. So this crucial point about what and how this is going to add to the deficit is the thing to watch here as these negotiations keep going. That really determines how many votes they need in the Senate. Do they need Democratic help, which they're not going to get in the Senate going forward. So just look for that. That's the most important thing. But I think they're onto something with the simplification part. I hope that survives whatever the bill is.
But I might lose my yacht deduction.
Just on your second yacht.
Oh, the second yacht. Okay, first one.
Now, the last time we did a major overhaul in this country of taxes was 1986. President Ronald Reagan, a Republican, of course, worked closely with a Democrat, Dan Rostenkowski, who headed up House Ways and Means Committee, I think. And they did quite a bit of simplification. They really, whatever federal involvement we have, for example, in affordable housing development today, was created back then through tax credits and certain the way bonds are handled. So it's interesting when you mention, you know,
will they have any Democratic help on this or any assistance? There's things that some Democrats in there, like you said, could be interested in, but
there's no evidence that they brought Democrats on board as part of the process. And this is what we saw in healthcare as well. You have to get, and I hate this word, forgive me, but you have to get stakeholders involved. You have to get, if you need Democratic votes, you got to bring Democrats in. Yeah. One other thing I will add, I did interview Mayor de Blasio, who was here fundraising for his reelection. And I asked him about this issue, this state income tax credit issue. And he essentially, I'll paraphrase here, he said that people in New York hate it, people on Wall Street hate the idea of not having that deduction. And he basically said Donald Trump's fancy friends at Goldman Sachs, again, I'm paraphrasing, but Donald Trump's fancy friends at Goldman Sachs will not stand for the elimination of this kind of deduction. So that may be something, if he gets a lot of pressure from investment bankers and the like and other real estate folks in New York, in specifically in the city, then that may be one of the things that he can give on as we move with the negotiations. So as Californians, we can wait and see, and maybe the final version just says, west of the Mississippi, I don't know. but he seemed to think that New Yorkers would not let the president keep that in.
Okay. One last question on this before we move on to the next topic. Someone in the audience asks, doesn't a simple tax code reduce the ability of government to drive economic activity with tax incentives, tax credits, and such? Will that neuter the government in a sense? Less, you're shaking your head, Chuck, which goes over.
I haven't been thrilled with what the government's done so far, so I'm not sure I want to propose. I mean, I think we saw this with the George Bush years, when the idea that deficit doesn't matter. We're going to make tax cuts, and the deficit doesn't matter. Well, it turned out it did matter. But again, I would say what Melissa said about healthcare, about tax reform. These are things I don't think that we talk about how fraught the country is, where we can't come to any decision, we can't do it. Infrastructure is another thing. I mean, we've got a lot of things that could be agreed upon if we were willing to take a moment, step back, and say what would be acceptable, what would not be acceptable, why couldn't we get on board with these things? And we've become so polarized that we aren't doing it. But I feel we may be moving toward that because right now we're doing nothing. And I think that there's a lot of momentum from people who feel disenfranchised, who want to see something. And I think that person is going to show up, whoever he is, TBD, and whenever he shows up, or she, it will be a movement.
Well, Chuck, you got some free time now.
I do. I'd like to announce, actually,
at this moment. A week to week first.
Yeah.
Just real quick, to get to the question, though.
Are you
first of all,
no,
you didn't, but that's okay. But here's the thing. The question was, are we getting rid of the government's ability to incentivize behavior? And look, there's a question, let's just start with, is that the government's job to be telling people how to do what lawful things that they should be doing?
There'd be plenty of conservatives who would say that's exactly what the government should not be doing.
Right. So let's start with that threshold question. But let's assume that the government should be telling us what legal things we should be doing more of. The way to do that, I think, to some degree, is to tax the things that you don't want people to do instead of giving deductions to people for things you want them to do. And I'll tell you why. Because the vast majority of Americans who don't want to spend $1,000 on an accountant to take advantage of every footnote and every piece of the thousands and it would fill the stage, the tax code. It ends up being regressive to some degree because people who could use some of the deductions can't afford them. They don't take them. It ends up being a way for wealthy people to hire fancy pants accountants and use these loopholes. It's not what we have seen is not necessarily a dramatic shift to doing all the right stuff by the American people. Our current tax code is not necessarily a big win for the folks who put it together. So I can see the idea of of trying to incentivize good behavior, but the practical impact, the status quo is just, I don't think we're there. I don't think you can look at the tax code and go, great job, section 101.5A. You made sure that everyone got a new computer. I don't know. So it's where we are isn't a great place. And so, I don't see if we're going to simplifying it to in a way such that people at the top and people at the bottom are all kind of subject to the same, maybe simplified rules, I think it can't do anything but bring some of the wealthier people into the fold.
Okay. Yeah. Well, moving along, how many of you participated in or went to the March for Science this past weekend? Quite a few hands. And this coming Saturday in Washington and maybe in some other cities too, I don't know, there's going to be the 2017 Climate March. So I just was kind of curious in getting the panel's views on all of these marches, and maybe, or just particularly the March for Science. What impact do you think they have? What, do you have any stories about any effect that they have? Start with you, Molly.
Yeah, I think all of these marches are just showing this momentum that's building. There are people, like Melissa said earlier, that have never participated in politics that are coming out to these marches. I have a lot of friends who, weren't even registered to vote a year ago that are now spending every Saturday at a different protest. They're going to Dianne Feinstein's house on Lyon Street. They are showing up at town halls. They're calling their congressmen, whatever it may be that they are participating in. And I think that's a real impact of this. I think it's getting people excited about the process. There's a real anger, and people are capitalizing on that and expressing it. And I think, it starts with going to a march, and then maybe you're showing up at your congressman's office, and then maybe you're starting your letter writing campaign, or maybe you're thinking about organizing a protest yourself, or maybe you start going to your city council meetings or thinking about running. And I think it's all this process and this getting engaged is so important. And I think that's like the big impact of these marches, whether or not they're influencing Trump, is up in the air. I think they are getting his attention for sure. On Saturday he put out that statement saying, of course we support science. We love scientists. Like, my administration will do more for science than any other administration. So he is paying attention. He doesn't like bad publicity. He doesn't like being called names, and he doesn't like seeing these signs, and everyone has really creative, funny signs out there. So I think it's working bit by bit.
It is a little hard to beat the scientists for the cleverness of their signs.
They Melissa, win. They thoughts? Totally win. Oh my gosh! Like, their signs were so amazing.
Were you down there for any of it?
Do what?
Did you cover? Were you down there for any of it?
No, I was not down there for that. I was at the Women's March, and their signs were awesome too. But I have to say, the scientists kind of not. I mean, there's lots of women at the Scientist March too, but I just mean I think it remains to be seen. I think it's a good thing for folks to come together and meet each other, because getting involved by yourself is not useful. You got to sort of figure out who else is in your community you can work with to do stuff. But at the same time, I think we should all be a little careful about tying science and a party together. The left has some questionable science stuff going on too. There's the anti-vaxxer movement. I mean, we're not folks who are in the Democratic Party aren't immune to some of the draws of the doctor you find on Google. That is something that the left is guilty of at times as well. So, and I think people will try to be careful about that. But I think as long as we're careful about making sure we're not just saying only Republicans are a problem with this, that we're talking about something that really transcends party, then we'll be in a good spot. But I didn't see to be fair, I wasn't there, but I hope that they kept in touch. I hope anyone who's, sort of motivated to get involved in politics reaches out and gets in touch with other people. But if not, then it is for naught. Then marching isn't the thing. Maybe you go, you need to go down to District 6 in Georgia and knock on doors. Maybe that's a better use of your time than marching together and then going back home and just sort of, doing your thing, watching Sean Spicer every day at 10 a.m.
Kind of a cheap shot, Melissa.
No, you live in San Francisco. You don't need to do anything more.
I am retired.
You live here. That's your political statement. You don't have to do more than that. Anyone who just pays rent
to live here in
San Francisco, we don't have to do more than that.
Okay.
But folks who, who've come from everywhere, they need to stay together, or else they're, then it's not going to be useful.
I just think the idea that you turn to someone and say, we're trying to turn out thousands of people to march for science. I mean, that guy's going to think, are you kidding? I'm going to turn up. And yet people did. And I think Molly's right. I think it's a moment in time when people are very, very activated. And that's the good thing about this terrible president, is he's activated so many people. But I think if we can focus it for good things, it could really work out. And science is, yeah. I mean, the fact that we'd have to defend science, that we'd have to say, yeah, science is a good thing. I would say most people would agree with that. And yet, at this point, we've allowed this discussion to become so fraught that you actually have to defend scientific data. And it's just, it's incredible. But therefore, we go out on the street and we march and say, yes, we do. We support science. That's a tenet of what we believe. And I think that's important. So it may not be the end of the world to have a demonstration, but I think it means something to someone.
My favorite sign showed a picture of the millionaire from Gilligan's Island, and it said, how many times did the millionaire save them? Zero. How many times did the professor? Almost every episode.
What do we want funding for science? When do we want it? After peer review?
Yeah. let's talk about the Sanctuary City. There was a big ruling recently on the Sanctuary City policies it wasn't on the policies, it was on Donald Trump's, was it specifically on an executive order he's made? Mm-hmm. Molly, can you explain what happened?
Sure. So Donald Trump in February, I believe, put out this executive order saying that any jurisdiction that has what they haven't fully defined, they haven't really defined what a sanctuary jurisdiction means, but basically what their definition is that any city that is resistant to federal immigration policy would be at risk of losing federal funding. San Francisco in the county of Santa Clara sued, and it came up in court about 2 weeks ago. And during that hearing, it was really interesting because the Justice Department lawyer, the lawyer arguing in favor of Trump's order, basically didn't defend the order as it was written. They defended a interpretation of the order that was much more narrow and basically said, this isn't going to impact all your federal funding. It's just going to impact these few grants, barely impacting San Francisco at all, and only like $1 million in Santa Clara. And that's pretty different from what Trump himself has said about the order. He's described it as a weapon. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions has said that he wants to claw back funding from sanctuary jurisdictions. So that was a really interesting dichotomy, and that was something that the judge, William Orrick, the federal judge who ruled on it, questioned during the hearing. He said, you know, how can you say that when the order is written this way? So you could kind of see the writing on the wall during the hearing itself. And so yesterday he came out with his ruling and did, in fact, issue a preliminary injunction nationwide. So the order, or Trump's order, is nullified right now. It'll probably be challenged in higher courts pretty soon. But he wrote in the order that this is, you know, it looks pretty unconstitutional to say that they can take the federal funding from these cities when they are, in fact, complying with the law as it is written. And he did say that the way that the Justice Department argued in favor of this narrow interpretation of it was just unreasonable, and it made no sense because it would make Trump's order basically useless. So it was a really interesting order to read yesterday, and today the Trump White House put out a statement saying, you know, they blamed it on the San Francisco judge. They made sure to highlight San Francisco. They mentioned the Kate Steinle case, and, you know, really attacked the Ninth Circuit. And today in an interview, Trump said that he is planning on dismantling the Ninth Circuit, which is something he can't really do. And also, this didn't even come from the Ninth Circuit. This was from the district court in San Francisco. So there's a lot going on here, to say the least.
Melissa, any thoughts on this?
So many. This was so weird. You were there. I was there when the oral argument happened on this. And we were all like, holy crap. When the Justice Department folks got up and said, this is just the president using the bully pulpit, this doesn't actually mean anything, we were all like, did he just, I'm not crazy, right? That was the thing I heard. It was insane to watch these lawyers say, this is just, you know, pinball, you know, Trump just being Trump. And you're like, no, this is an executive order that's like a thing. And it caused places like Miami and Lansing, Michigan to pull back from their sanctuary policies because they were so nervous about this thing. So that was freaky. Like, it's weird that you get a surprise in court like that. Usually that stuff's in the papers, but it wasn't. And then they just said it and was like, okay, weird. But there are a couple of really important things at issue here. And this is something that sort of cuts across everything when it comes to federal funds. And everyone's like, because that's the thing. Like, oh, just let's pull their federal funds. Berkeley, let's pull their federal funds. Congress allocates federal funding. So if you want to pull federal funds, you go through Congress. You don't get to sign a piece of paper and declare that federal funds are, you know, should be withdrawn from a particular thing. So that was one thing that was important about this case that the judge really talked about in a 49-page ruling. Fun. You know, that only Congress has the right to withdraw funds or to sort of draw a line and say funds can only be used for this or that. It is not the president's purview to do that. But let's assume that Congress says, okay, we're going to allocate these funds and then you can do whatever you want. Let's assume Congress sort of baked in the discretion needed to, like, remove sanctuary city funds. Even if that's true, the funds have to match the issue. You can't take away, like, school lunch money, federal school lunch money, because of a sanctuary city, right? They have to, like, one has to match the other, right? So that's what the government was arguing, was, you know, that we're only talking about just these very few little funds because that's what's at issue with the Justice Department. And the judge was like, well, wait a minute. That's not what the order says. The order is incredibly broad. You want to come in here and tell me it only applies to, like, these three little Department of Justice grants? No. You're asking me to write a new executive order for you. I'm not going to do that. So this one was really indefensible. And like she said, you could see the judge was just not having it. You could tell at the hearing. There were things, I'm not saying everything the Trump administration does is indefensible. I want to be clear. Their second, immigration, you know, policy may be upheld. But this one was such a problem because they kept saying, oh, well, this is just a restatement of the law. And the judge actually relied on statements from Jeff Sessions and the president who came out and said, it's a weapon. This is our new policy. And it didn't help matters that in the middle of, while the clerks in the judge's office are, like, feverishly making this 49-page order, that Jeff Sessions sends a letter to the California Department of Corrections saying, prove you go along with the federal immigration policies or we're going to cut your federal funding. Unhelpful. And as a lawyer, when your client does stuff like that, you're like, oh my God, what are you doing? And so you can just picture these DOJ attorneys just, like, face planting. Unhelpful. So it comes out, and then, you know, Donald Trump says it's the Ninth Circuit's fault, which, you know, again, we're not there yet. We're going to be. But a 49-page ruling is clearly done with a view toward an appeal. They know they're going to be looked at on appeal, and so they just sort of left no stone unturned. And so it was, you know, it's one of these things where, bless the DOJ lawyers, they did the best they could defending this incredibly poorly thought-out executive order, whose purpose appears to be just sort of a press release. It didn't appear to actually do what it said, what the president said it was going to do. And by the way, I will end with this. Jeff Sessions, Senator Jeff Sessions, voted for Judge Orrick when he was appointed to the federal district court. So I think they're in a funky little place right now. And aiming at the Ninth Circuit appears to be a bit of a deflection from what was a really bad idea, it seems like.
Very good. Maybe briefly before we get to the end, any thoughts on Dianne Feinstein? She's raising money. Are we 100% sure she's running? No.
I think she's 100% sure she's running. I think she really wants to run. But I think even the town hall meeting she had was a bit of a shock. I think that's not what she expects.
Yeah.
She's 84 years old. She can be very contentious. I remember many editorial board meetings at the Chronicle. If she doesn't like the question, she really doesn't like the question. I can just tell you that. She's in such a powerful place. I mean, where she is in her career and in those hallowed halls, it's important for her to be there. But I think she's going to have to be convinced not to run. That's as clear as I could say it.
Her husband has had some health issues.
Yep, serious health issues.
And so my understanding is she's sort of figuring that out and making a determination at the town halls. Like, she did not look like she was having any fun, and there's a reason why she has never had one. And so to have these people yelling, at one point she said, and I'm serious, she said, if you think you know more about Syria than I do, then come on up here. And it was like, oh, wow.
Girl, you did not say
I was
that.
Like, oh, snap. So it was. She was not thrilled to be there. And at one point, she said, "If you don't like me, then you can just leave." I mean, like, it was that kind of thing. So it, I think if you're, you know, your husband's maybe ill, or and you're sort of staring down the next 6 years of this, of having to do town halls, being sort of forced to do them, and then show up and take it from people who you regard as knowing about as much about Syria as you have in your little pinky, you know, I'm not sure that's the kind of thing she wants to spend another 6 years doing. We have come to a point where people are demanding these town halls. You can't go through another 6 years without doing them. So you're looking down the, you know, you're looking at your future and you're saying, you know, I've got, my husband's ill and this looks really unfun. I am not 100% convinced that she is going to run again, despite the fact that she's raised a ton of money. And if she ran, she would definitely win because the Democratic Party would never run anyone against her. But I'm not sure. And I'll give you an example. So at the Dianne Feinstein town hall, a group of folks said they wanted Barbara Lee to run. Congresswoman Barbara Lee represents Oakland, progressive. They said, we want Barbara Lee to run for Senate. And so you call Barbara Lee's office. Would you care to comment? Now, any other year, they would say, absolutely not. We'd never run against Dianne Feinstein. That's crazy. Put that rumor to bed right now. But this time, not a word. This time, they refused to comment. Like, as if even Lee, as in Congresswoman Lee, is like, maybe I'll just chill it out over here and see what she's going to do. So there is a big question mark this year. And I'm not saying she's not going to run, but I'm saying there's a seriously large question mark over whether she's going to run this year, I think. And I think it's reflected in Congresswoman Lee and her experience at these town halls.
Molly, do you agree?
Yeah. And there was a poll that came out a couple weeks ago that said, once people found out that Feinstein would be 85 when she ran again, I think a majority of people said they wouldn't support her running again. So I think that's something that she's probably working into her calculus as well. It's obviously just one poll. I wasn't at the town hall last week, but I was at the fake town hall in February where she spoke at, I forgot the name of the organization.
BBC.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And downtown, and all these protesters showed up. People inside the event were, you know, holding signs, yelling at her, trying to get, you know, her to say that she was ready to impeach Trump, to call Trump a fascist. So there's real anger among her constituents, especially here in San Francisco. And I don't think she's ignoring it. I think, you know, she seemed kind of baffled by it and, you know, said, you know, I'm always available. You guys can talk to me anytime. She didn't seem to quite get why people were so upset with her. So I think that is something that she's going to be thinking about a lot.
Wait until she goes to speak at Berkeley.
Yeah.
one final thing then before news
quiz. Actually, just one quick thing on this PPIC poll, the poll by Dianne Feinstein. This is interesting. So they ask a group of people, do you think, you know, it's a good idea for Dianne Feinstein to run? And, you know, they say a certain percentage says yes or no. And then they say, okay, but FYI, she'd be 85. And then they sort of watch where the numbers move to. Among Democrats, her numbers went down 8 points. Among Republicans, her numbers went up 10 points.
Wow.
So really? It's actually the Democrats who are the ones who are, you know, potentially abandoning ship, you know, because maybe they want, you know, new blood, et cetera. But I thought it was so interesting that the Republicans found that to be a big asset, and dramatically so, and the Democrats were actually the ones whose numbers moved, if you look at the crosstabs, you know, ultimately.
So. Interesting. I did want to talk about what I think is kind of a sobering thing, and that is this spate of, like, live-streamed, where people have, you know, through Facebook, they've video-streamed themselves live, committing murders, sexual assaults, suicides. Just earlier today, there was a man in Alabama who, live-streamed his own suicide on Facebook. Any thoughts on this? I mean, what...
Well, and Twitter is now talking about opening up a live video stream. And, you know, transparency is such a buzzword. We're so concerned with transparency and freeing up the internet and so forth. But it's that question of, because we have the technology, do we have to use the technology? I mean, we're offering an open channel to everyone. And I think there's a theory. We could probably say that that's a good thing. But... there's a certain number of people who are deeply, deeply troubled, who are going to use this because they want to have the maximum amount of attention and effect. And I'm just not sure this is sustainable. It may be a great idea, that's not a good idea.
Any thoughts? Melissa, Molly?
we just, I was at this event to kick off the building of the suicide barrier on the Golden Gate Bridge. Right, because they say this is a thing, this is a tantalizing thing that we're making it so easy for people to just jump right off and hit the water. So we're going to put up this barrier. And that's what I think about, that it's, are we making this such a attractive option for
and
people?
Too easy.
Are we making it too easy? This live streaming, are we making it too easy? So easy that they feel like this is the place where they can sort of make their last statement, like people use the Golden Gate Bridge for. And I if we're going to do that on the bridge, I'm not sure how you justify allowing it in other mediums. Having said that, I don't have the answer for how we stop it, right? You do want to be able to say, oh, I'm at this riot or I'm at this event and I really want to go live. I want the world to see like this really important thing that's happening. And yet filter out things like that. I'm not clear on how that would work, but it seems to me if we're going to put a suicide barrier on the Golden Gate Bridge because it's just too juicy for people to resist, then there has to be some kind of something built in, maybe a 10-second delay. I don't know. And I don't know whose job it would be to sit there and make sure that wasn't happening, and I don't envy whoever would have to do that. But there has to be something, unless we're just going to, as a society, say, we're cool with this. We're going to bring, you know, take the good with the bad and, you know, let people do that. And, you know, you kind of have to make a deal one way or the other. Either we're fine with people using it or we're going to, you know, build in some protections. But you can't have it both ways. You can't go, wow, that's really terrible.
Yeah.
But let's not do anything.
I know Molly wants to speak, but is it going to decrease suicide? Suicides are taking place. Is it going to decrease murders? It's not going to decrease murders. Do we not want to see those? No, we don't. But is that reason enough to not do it? That's all happening. We just aren't seeing it. Now, I'm just being devil's advocate, but it's a terrible thing to confront, but all those things are happening now. We're just not seeing them. So, I don't know. I think it's a very slippery slope. But
Molly?
I think there is such a fine line here, and where for Facebook, for example, where do they draw the line between, you know, someone live streaming a confrontation with police where unarmed person is shot by police versus a suicide. You know, I think that is like a distinction that they have frankly had trouble with in the past, you know, censoring, you know, photos of women breastfeeding and things like that. They got a lot of negative coverage last year for censoring the photo of the young girl covered in napalm in My Lai, the like famous photo. So I think Facebook historically has not been great with these sort of distinctions, and I would kind of worry that there would be censorship in a way that would limit what is, you know, some really valuable things for people to see. You know, I think a lot of these police cases have been exposed by cell phone videos. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. Let's move on to our news quiz before we break up for the night. I'm going to read out a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. If you get it right, Fran will deliver some chocolate to you. If you do win, please then hold off on the other questions and let someone else win. Our first question, what country was recently shaken by a 6.9 earthquake? Did you see this? No one. Sir. Chile, that's right, Chile. When? I want to
say. Yesterday, day before? Yeah, Monday, I think.
I believe so. Next question, Nordstrom. It's not selling Ivanka's stuff, but it is selling a special pair of blue jeans for $425. Your hand was up there before. It's even done. The question is, so what's so special about these jeans?
Mud. Yeah, pseudo mud.
Pseudo mud. They're made to look like they've got old mud caked on them.
Finally, I'm ahead of the fashion curve.
Okay. Russian hackers are believed to be behind the hacking of what French campaign? Whose campaign, sir? No.
They want Le Pen.
Macron, that's right. You're not going to get me to pronounce a French name correct. I'm sorry. I don't have those talents. Let's see. What center-left Democratic leader is going to be paid $400,000 to speak to a Wall Street bank? Sir, your hand again was first. Barack Obama, that's correct.
Center left, that's very good.
Yeah. What? He's not going to have another campaign in front of him, so
that's
what the
good.
Heck.
I like that.
Okay. Who is being sued by yogurt maker Chobani for spreading damaging conspiracy theories? Way in back there, sir.
Alex Jones.
Alex Jones. He's a conspiracy theorist and the InfoWars guy and child custody expert, I guess. Let's see. Who claimed not to be the candidate of the far-right National Front in the French presidential election? Sir. Marine Le Pen, the candidate of the National Front in the French election. That is correct. Okay, scandal and shareholder anger created a contentious annual meeting for what big bank yesterday? Ma'am, I saw you.
Wells Fargo,
that is correct. Just a few more. Let's see. Speaking on the California Senate floor, what did Senator Scott Wiener call President Donald Trump?
Was it a wiener?
He did not call him himself. It was a movie reference. Let's put it that way. No one? Okay. He called him the Manchurian candidate. He was arguing he was a... Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, but I hope I'm not too far off. Elena Milashina. She's a journalist with a Russian opposition newspaper, Novaya Gazeta. I can't pronounce French names. I'm not going to pronounce Russian either any better. She has been forced to go into hiding after receiving death threats for her reporting of what story? This is a story that took place. It's something occurring in part of the Russian Federation. Sir?
Chechnya?
It is in Chechnya. What's happening?
Oh, the gate.
No, sir?
About the persecution of gays.
Right, the murders and the arrests and the concentration camps for gays.
Should have gone to hiding?
Yeah, she's trying to flee the country, too. The director of Silence of the Lambs died at age 73. Who was he? Sir?
Jonathan Demme,
that is correct. And I think we have one more. Am I correct, Fran?
Yes.
I can count. Good. So, according to a new survey, who is most likely to fall victim to the IRS scam identity scheme? Have you, you know, where they call up and you owe a bunch of taxes, you better pay right now or really horrible things will happen.
Donald Trump.
No. Do you want to guess, ma'am? Sorry? No. Sir. Sorry?
Immigrants?
Nope. Sir.
No,
sorry. Sir, way in back?
The young?
Yes, it's actually millennials. This is according to Bloomberg. Millennials are less likely than Gen Xers or baby boomers to receive these calls, but they are 6 times more likely than older generations to give their credit card numbers to the caller and twice as likely to give their social security numbers. So, yes. Well, listen, we'll be back.
I know. Explain yourself, Molly.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to talk about on Monday, May 15th, right here in San Francisco. You can find our week-to-week news quiz on Huffington Post. Thank you. Thank you, Melissa Kane, Chuck Nevious, and Molly Riley. Thanks to all of you here and everyone watching and listening online. Have a great week.